room as fire drifts away. I feel the attempt to warm my bones, scarce of the signs of child's play. This cold is useless without the snow when I'm on the road. Bound for home, back to what I know, back to Idaho.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Susie Vitello, author of the new novel Bitterroot from Sibylline Press. Susie's published fiction includes the novel Faultland and the young adult novels The Moment Before and the Empress Chronicles series. Her award-winning short fiction and nonfiction has appeared in the Rumpus Mississippi Review, the Southampton Review, and various anthologies and other literary journals. Susie's also one of the best writing teachers, editors, and book coaches in the Pacific Northwest, if not the whole country. In the words of fellow Portland writer Renee Denfeld, Bitterroot strikes at the heart of loss and the alchemy of change. Bitterroot is an exceptional novel by a great talent. And in the words of Cheryl Strayed, Susie is, quote, smart, kind, thoughtful, and good to her bones, and all of those qualities shine through in her writing. This is my third interview with Susie, and it's always a joy to talk with her, whether the subject is books or her beloved Portland Timbers and Trailblazers. And thorns. Please join us for our conversation with Susie Vitello, which is already in progress. Well, Susie, welcome back. This is our third interview, and I'm so happy to be talking with you again.
Thanks, Ken. It's always a pleasure to come here and chat with you.
And the last time was July 2021 during the summer, and it was an extreme heat dome event in Portland. Temperatures in the triple digits. Today, it's just in the high 90s. So much for global warming.
They haven't solved it yet since 2021.
No, but we're 20 degrees cooler, so
yeah,
for the time being.
Thank goodness.
Now, at that time, we discussed your previous novel, Faultland, which was speculative fiction taking place in Portland in 2030. And Bitterroot takes place in more contemporary times, I think just probably a few years ago. And it shares some of the same themes, though: siblings, family conflict, class division, right-wing extremism. Given these common themes in your work, what are reasons to set the new book in the recent past rather than the not-too-distant future?
Well, that's a great question, Ken. I think that, you know, it wasn't conscious. I think it had more to do with how much I wanted to be particular about the politics and how much I wanted to speculate. So Faultland was and is a speculative fiction. So I invented a few things, right? Remember the face wands and, you know,
oh,
those
yes,
things?
Yeah. Yes. Also the big one, the quake that gives the book its
quake,
title.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was more of a fabrication in my, you know, imagination. And Bitterroot could be happening now. It could have been, you know, I set it in Idaho because of all of the legislation that's happening there now. Not only the abortion issue, but a lot of scary stuff about book banning and making sure that kids do not have access to anything LGBTQ, you know?
Yeah, very anti-gay legislation.
Yes. I mean, the libraries now, they have these signs where kids have to be checked in by their parents so that in order to be able to go into certain parts of the library. You know, they're treating it like it's a festival where there's alcohol or something. You know, you got to have the special wristband kind of a deal.
Well, they're probably allowed alcohol and guns, just not literature.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's a little more pressing in a sort of a realism way, Bitterroot, than Faultland was.
And you mentioned Idaho. The book takes place in a fictional town in Idaho, Steeplejack. Mm-hmm. It's described in the book as that quaint silver mining town you pass through on your way from Seattle to Missoula. That can only be one.
Yeah, which one is it?
So it's loosely based on Wallace, Idaho. So why not use the real Wallace, Idaho in the story? I know you've been asked that before.
Yeah, so I didn't really want to trespass on an actual town because, you know, it's one thing to say Portland or New York because those are big cities and
anything can happen.
Right. It doesn't feel as personal. So if you're going to say things that might leave a bad taste in someone's mouth. I think, you know, if it's a small town that puts you in, I don't know, the kind of territory that I didn't really want to be in. So, and also I wanted the freedom to, for the landscape. You know, I made it closer to Coeur d'Alene than Wallace is. And, you know, just for purposes of ease of getting back and forth to hospitals and things like that in the narrative. Yeah. So there were some, you know, functional reasons why I chose to invent a town, and also some that just made me feel better about that. It felt less exploitative, I guess.
Yeah. And what an interesting town. I mean, the real Wallace.
Have you spent time there?
If I can just give you a little personal story real quick.
Sure.
When I was in college here in Portland, it was my sophomore year, I got a gig actually emceeing burlesque. Burlesque is a nice word for strippers.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they hired me. I basically told jokes and introduced the girls. But trip, we drove out to Wallace, Idaho, and with three girls, and we played the Elks Club there.
Ah.
And we checked into a hotel when we got there. We didn't spend the night. We drove back afterwards, but they had to shower and get ready and all that. And it turned out to be a brothel.
Yes.
So they rented us a room. Nothing else was included, just the room. But yeah, and then we were at the Elks Club that night and drove home to Portland.
Yeah, no, prostitution was big business there until very recently, actually. In fact, when I went there to do some research, rented an Airbnb, and the woman who owned the Airbnb was really excited to share some of that colorful past with us. And so she pointed out some various houses that were until recently brothels. And, oh, well, you know, our kids, they would, on their lunch hour from the high school down there.
Really?
Yes. They would partake.
Very advanced population.
Yeah. But, you know, what was interesting about that was women were pretty powerful there. The brothels weren't, you know, male-owned. They had madams and good salaries.
And I know your husband has relatives in Sandpoint, Idaho, so you have some familiarity with that town. And that's not a silver mining town. It's somewhat of a resort town with Lake Pend'Oreille and nearby Skeen. So why Wallace? Did you want kind of that more working class, maybe lower middle class ambiance to it? Or
yes, I did. I wanted there to be sort of a mixture of, because Wallace really is a working class town. There is not as much tourism. You know, they don't have the advantage of having the huge lake, but they do have people that come to do like mountain biking and hiking and art. But people, you know, work in the mine still, and there's commerce going on, and you know, it's just a little bit more low key than Sandpoint, but just as fraught politically, I think.
Yeah, my impression, I was in Sandpoint years ago, and my impression, it was more kind of left, progressive, you know, artists. But I think you said in a recent book reading, Susie, that it's really extremes on both sides.
Correct.
Now.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so.
And a lot of Idaho's like that, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Idaho is a very interesting state. And, you know, I'm curious, you know, just to get a little tiny bit more political, you know, recently when Kamala Harris was the presumptive nominee, and I guess as of today, she's the actual nominee. But anyway, within hours, you know, people were donating money and all that. And there was a map that showed where this money was coming from. And it was all over the West, except for Idaho. There was like no dots in
nothing
Idaho
in the state?
All.
Wow.
Nothing.
Yeah. You know, it's weird because I thought Boise was somewhat to the left, mm-hmm. Certainly outside of it's not. I read that Idaho actually had the first Jewish governor in the country.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm sure that
a lot
since
of
then
contradictions there.
Yeah, I'm sure that since then there's been some donations, but just in that immediate fervor.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
Now we talked about when you went there and you discovered these anti-gay laws, including the threat of arresting teachers and librarians, mm-hmm. not just checking kids at the door for IDs. That makes its way into Bitterroot. The main character and narrator is Hazel McKenzie. Her twin brother Kento and his husband Tom want to have a baby, but it's against Idaho state law for same-sex couples to use a surrogate or even adopt children. That you say that in the book. That's true in real life too?
Well, that's the sort of the slight speculative deal. That's where it's headed, I feel. And
definitely,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So I wanted there to be this, you know, reason why her twin brother did not settle there, settled in Seattle instead. but still had wanted to engage another character in the book for the purposes of surrogacy.
Because he grew up in Steeplejack, yeah. So that other character lives there. Right. And yeah, we won't get too much into the plot, but it kind of takes off from there. I want to talk about that a little too, Susie. It's so interesting because you've got Idaho, where a lot of this stuff is either illegal or on its way mm-hmm. to being banned. Mm-hmm. And then Kento's living in he's living in Seattle. But even if he went just a few miles west, he'd be in Washington State, and mm-hmm. it's totally different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you've got that kind of red state, blue state, among everything else that's going on there, that split.
I mean, as we know here in Oregon, I think the demarcation is actually the mountains, right? The Cascades.
Oh, yeah, because a lot of people in eastern Oregon want to just kind of pack it. Well, they don't even want to pack up and go. They want Idaho to annex them, I think.
They want to be adopted by Idaho.
Yeah.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Well, we don't allow those adoptions. We could play this game, too. Now, talking about splits and divides, the Bitterroot Mountain Range borders Idaho and Montana, so it's about 15 miles due east of the real Wallace. And the main character, Hazel, has a tattoo of the Bitterroots. Mm-hmm. I remember we talked about the title for Faultland and had the multiple meanings, the literal one about the earthquake. And of course, Bitterroot is the mountain range, but there's a lot more going on there too, right? You chose it for the multiple meanings?
I did, yeah. A little triple entendre, I guess. You know, if you look at bitter and root, and, you know, when you can kind of think about what are the different uses of those words, there are some family history there.
You know, oh, yeah, we'll get into that. Yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. And, you know, bitter is also a descriptor that comes up with the discussion of Hazel's family of origin. So, yeah.
Bitter, angry, frustrated.
Exactly.
Kind of the mood of the country now in a lot of ways, not just Idaho.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, and this whole idea of family, roots, you know, where does it come from? And...
Oh, right. I wanted to talk about that because one of the common themes in your work, and I mentioned it, is the focus on siblings, among other things. Mm-hmm. And in Bitterroot, the siblings are the twins, Hazel and Kento. Mm-hmm. And sibling connection and conflict is a classic theme in a lot of literature. What attracts you to writing these characters? Because that relationship's in a lot of your books. Faultland had three siblings.
Yes.
A brother and two sisters.
Yeah. I just am so fascinated by the spectrum of dysfunction in families.
Yes. What fertile ground.
yeah. It just is. It's ripe for all kinds of exploitation. Yeah. And, you know, siblings in particular are just very fascinating to me, always have been. You know, my sister and I, she's passed away now, but we were 2 years apart, and we were, I think, just the opposite ends of the gene jar. You know, she stayed in the hometown. I left, you know, that kind of thing.
So very different personalities, too? Or?
Very different personalities.
But were you close personally?
Yes. And, you know, I mean, we lived all over the place when we were kids. We moved a lot. So we were each other's, you know, constant companions for a lot of that time. Spent a lot of time in our grandparents' attic while our parents were in school. So we were very, you know... We were as close as you can get, really. But ideologically, we ended up on different sides of the map, you know, both geographically and ideologically. So, you know, I think that stuff stays with you.
And let's talk about some of that family dysfunction. And we'll go back to Hazel and Kento.
Okay.
They're the children of a Japanese mother and a white American father. Mm-hmm. So they're biracial. Mm-hmm. Which seems to mystify some Republican politicians these days.
Indeed.
How can anybody be more than one thing? Yeah. And that plays a part in the story, especially when Hazel finds out about her family history going back to World War II and the internment camps for the first generation of Japanese Americans living in the country. They were called Nisei,
The Nisei, they were specialized, conscripted to the army because... For the reason of them being fluent in both Japanese and American, you know, English. And they used them basically as spies. Most of the Nisei had attended at one point in their education schooling in Japan, even though they were born and raised in the United States. So they handpicked, you know, a few dozen of these young men and used them as spies during World War II. and while their families were sent to concentration camps.
In this case, it's
basically
the
internment camps, but I call them concentration camps.
Well, it's actually described that way when I looked up the definition. The one you talk about is Tule Lake War Relocation Center in Northern California. There's another famous one around there, Manzanar. Mm-hmm. There's been books and movies about that. So Hazel's, was it her grandfather who was actually in the military? And then her father...
It was her great-grandfather.
Her great-father, and then her grandfather was in an internment camp with his mother.
Right, as a child,
because they didn't trust Japanese-Americans at the time.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, so the bitterness, you know, kind of the intergenerational bitterness. And that is something that actually I sort of took from my own family experience
as well. Yes, I want to talk, because your paternal grandparents and your father... Just before the start of World War II, they were forced to leave Austria.
Correct.
You know, a smart move, you know, in hindsight, certainly.
Yeah.
And that was because of a persecution. They had Jewish blood, or they had converted to Lutheran religion.
Yes, exactly. You know, purity laws, right? So my grandfather, Helmut Freisinger, he was a physician, and it was very clear that he would get nowhere if he stayed there.
He was marked as Jewish.
No
matter his
even though, you know, because he's 100% Jewish blood, you know.
Right.
I don't know how they found that out, but because his family did convert. But anyway, the writing was on the wall. So he left to the States a little earlier than my grandmother and my father. My father was a baby. And they came out, my grandmother and my father came on the last boat out called the Rex. And everybody on the docket there was, they claimed that they were from Israel, except for my mom and dad, or my dad and my grandmother. And at that point, you know, they had to say German, right? Because the Germans had taken over Austria.
Right.
And oh boy, did they not like Germans. My grandmother remained bitter till the day she died about that.
Yeah, I'm Jewish, so my family's not a big fan of the country. We don't forget. Now, that fear of indiscrimination against Japanese Americans during the war mirrors kind of what we're seeing now in the country. Maybe it's, we've always seen it in the country, a tragic part of American history, whether it's the second-class citizenship of women, people of color, immigrants, pretty much anyone who is in a white male Christian, heterosexual male.
Indeed.
And in Bitterroot, you have the fictional white supremacist group, Patriot Root, which is not all that fictional, just the names have been changed.
Right.
It has very real counterparts, not just in Idaho. And in Faultland, you created the neo-Nazi vigilante group, the Cascade Citizens Alliance, which were running unchecked in this not-too-distant future, especially after the quake. So this political theme is very common in your kind of this extreme right, this... it's autocratic, totalitarian, hateful, discriminatory. I could use stronger words, but I wouldn't be able to broadcast. certainly make use of that.
I do, but I'm always wanting to figure out a way out, you know? I mean, I like to think that my novels end on a happy note, or a hopeful note at least. So I think that's the way that I work out the struggles that I have myself. I mean, we're all a little bit political junkies right now, you know, checking our social media to see what's the latest thing.
Yeah, I know.
You know who
right after
said.
Kamala, all of a sudden I'm on Twitter, and I had left that for a while.
Right.
Threads, I see you on there too.
And, yeah.
I don't really post much, but I just look to see what the latest news is. And you're getting all sorts of, it's not just late breaking news, because there's not a whole lot of that. But you're getting kind of people's enthusiasm, which has certainly picked up quite a bit.
Indeed. Yeah. It was stunning to me how the tone shifted all of a sudden. And that's part of the puzzle of life, I think. I mean, the good guys are always trying to figure out how to win, you know, and it looks like the odds are stacked against them. And then lo and behold, they figure out some way.
It seems like Kamala is like the cavalry arriving.
Yeah. I've always had hope that we'd turn things around. Now, of course, the election hasn't happened yet, but, you know.
But we all have a lot more hope than we did, say, a month
Correct.
Ago.
Correct, yeah.
Now, it's narrated in the first person by Hazel, the main character and the twin. And your previous novel, Faultland, was written in, I think, close third person. So you're narrating it from the in third person, but from the point of view of the character And there were three main characters in there, so we each got their point of view in different sections of the book. And I remember you said at that interview that you actually started that book in the first person.
I did.
Faultland. So why did that work for you for Bitterroot and not for Faultland? You had Hazel's voice and...
Right. Well, because I had three characters. You know, to do three characters in first person, I think can come off as a little jarring to the reader.
Because you don't know who's speaking at any one time.
Yeah. And you know, as a reader, you tend to align with the characters that you first encounter, right? You think that's their story. And I think in third person, you can have a little more nuance with that. So you can put them on more equal footing. And, you know, Hazel's voice just kind of came to me, similar to my YA book, The Moment Before, which I also talked to you about years
yes,
ago.
Yeah. Yes, I remember.
10 years ago. Gosh. Yeah. So now the book that I'm writing now, which hopefully will be out from Sibylline Press in spring of 2026, that is kind of like Faultland in that I've got three point of view third person characters.
And that's close third.
Close third. Mm. Uh-huh. And next year's book, which is out by Running Wild Press, called The Bequest, that has two characters close third. So I'm leaning, you know, interesting the departure with the first person, because I'd kind of moved to third person. It just allows more, you know, you can do more things with it. But I don't know, Hazel's voice just needed to be heard, and only her voice. She demanded it.
Yeah, what a great character. Now, as both a writer and an editor and a masterful writing coach, and you have that reputation, you're acquainted with a number of writers and their process, their writing process. In that book event at Broadway Books, you describe some as pantsers. Mm-hmm. In other words, writers who make it up as they go along, writing by the seat of their pants.
Right.
And that's contrasted with plotters, people who outline in advance. And in your Substack, you describe yourself as kind of a hybrid, a pantser plotter.
Yes, exactly. You know, because if I was just doing the straight pantser, I would just end up in cul-de-sac after cul-de-sac, you know, just following these rabbits wherever they go, you know. So I have to impose some structure on that, but I don't do it right away.
Yeah, right? That's what I was curious about, because this is actually somewhat of a mystery thriller. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really kept me reading. And there's all sorts of really great twists and turns, which are not out of the blue. They're not absurd. They're foreshadowed. Mm-hmm. You know, for a reader who picks it up, maybe somebody's used to reading mysteries. Yeah. We'll find that along the way. And that seems like something much more difficult for a pantser than a plotter.
Yeah. Well, you know, my formula, if you can call it that, is usually to just give myself free rein for like 50 to 100 pages when I'm starting something. And that was the case with Bitterroot. I, you know, just let Hazel do what she wanted to do. And then, you know, I realized, oh, wait a second. I've got to make these things come full circle. And in order to do that, you know, I better write a synopsis like right now so I can figure out how this ends. And that's what I do. It's at an early-ish point in the process, I write a synopsis, and that synopsis then becomes a dynamic document that I change as I go on. But it gives me a little bit of a, possibilities, A, B, C, and it can change. But it harnesses in that pantser in me a little bit.
Do you have to go back and kind of foreshadow a bit more?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. And mostly a lot of the work that I do later in editing has to do with backstory. So I'm trying to develop a little bit more of an emotional rapport with the character.
Backstory is not in the book itself, but it's in your mind as you're writing.
Both. Oh. Yeah. So uh-huh. I'll have separate documents where I say, well, this happened to this character, you know, when she was 10, right? And then maybe I'll take like a paragraph of that and stick it in somewhere. So it just kind of gives me more of an understanding of where she is emotionally in story present to put those things in there, and really helps me flesh out some characters.
Yeah, I'm reading this biography now of Elaine May,
oh,
who's just this fantastic a comedy writer, actress. Well, not just comedy. She, Nichols and May, the improvisational duo in the 60s. Very interesting person, very strong, but very difficult.
Yeah.
But also great. Very funny. Yeah, when she directed her movies, she was always asking, why is this character doing this? Explain this action. So she was just full of this backstory. Mm-hmm. I mean, that went beyond comedy. That was just good storytelling.
Yeah.
But exactly. It seems like you're doing the exact same thing here in your
books. And as a writer, it's very satisfying too. When I coach other writers oftentimes, you know, it depends on what, where they are in the process of writing, but if they're kind of more at the beginning and they're trying to get a sense of their characters, there's a little questionnaire that I stole out of the New York Times that's supposed to be for love to find out what your perfect match is.
Oh, you know? Interesting.
Yeah, it's a little questionnaire. And so I say,
so you give that to your date or something?
Yes, exactly. So I give that to the writers so that they can appropriate that for their characters.
What a great idea.
Yeah, it just kind of offers a different level, I guess.
Because you're basically finding out about this person you might be getting involved with,
exactly.
And the writer's finding out about a character that they're spending the rest of the book with.
Bingo.
Now, Bitterroot's main character, Hazel, who we talked about, she has an interesting profession that I don't think I've come across in fiction. She's a forensic artist, sketching dead people, sometimes maimed, and she often fills in gaps in the actual body, decomposing body, when she draws the sketch. And this is a profession for her, but she also does her own art based on a Japanese practice called kuzoku?
Kuzozu.
Kuzozu.
Yeah.
I wonder, Susie, can you tell us about kuzozu? Because I had never heard of that before. And why you picked a forensic artist for Hazel's work?
Well, I wanted her to be an artist. I wanted her to be a visual artist. I've always sort of aspired to that. I could never do it myself. I don't have that talent. But I am very interested in people
innate,
that do.
Doesn't it?
Yeah,
exactly. I can't draw either.
Well, my grandmother and my grandfather both were very good artists. So it's in the family, but not with me. Passed me by. Mm. But anyway, so I just did, you know, got into one of those internet tunnels, and I found this collection that was actually in the London Museum of artists that depicted this kuzozu, and it is the artistic rendering of the decomposition of a body after death. And so there's...
So where are their subjects? Are they going to the morgue then? Or
Yes. I mean, I would imagine that's part of it, you know, because historically, right, this is a lot of people ended up doing artistic renderings from dead bodies.
Face mask, like
right.
You've seen Beethoven's
exactly.
Death mask.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And because, you know, in this is a Japanese art, the drawings are very elegant, and they actually, you know, have disintegrating clothing on them as the body goes through those processes. And it's quite beautiful. In the Western culture, death is very scary to us, I think, and we don't really... I mean, once you're dead, you're dead. You know, he put you in the furnace, burn you up, or bury you, or whatever.
But not necessarily all West. I mean, Mexico, they have Day of the
correct,
Dead.
Correct, correct, yeah.
They kind of make peace with the dead and honor them.
Correct, yeah. Now, I'm thinking more Americans, you know, this is what we do, and, you know, and Europeans as well. And this is just a way to honor the process of life begetting more life kind of thing, which corresponded, I think, to the way I see the world and life and death. So anyway, I wanted my obsession to become Hazel's obsession. See how that works? So you just impose those things on a character. And did a little more research and decided, yeah, that she's really into that. And so she ends up doing a triptych of her own mother. And that just freaks everybody out in Steeplejack. You know, they find out about it. Like, she's a witch.
As if they're not freaked out enough by Hazel and her family.
Right.
So as part of her job and also her art, Hazel is steeped in death. Now, on a personal level, she also experiences a lot of grief. First, the passing of her parents in the book, then her husband Ethan's death in a car accident. Not a spoiler, it happens in the very first chapter. Mm-hmm. Now, I interviewed recently another wonderful Portland author, Kimberly King Parsons.
Oh, yeah.
And her latest novel was We Were the Universe, which also concerns grief. A lot of it's about that. And Kim herself has a tattoo of a line from an Amy Hempel story. The story is, I think, Amy Hempel's first in the cemetery where Al Jolson is buried.
Mm-hmm.
And the tattoo and the quote, the very last line of that story is, "Fluent now in the language of grief."
Mm.
Now, your first husband died in a car accident, and you talked about your sister, your late sister, Patty. She died of cancer, I think, about 6-7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a language you're also, sadly, personally familiar with.
Yeah, yeah. My husband at 25, and then my sister-in-law at 50 of pancreatic cancer, and then my sister, more recently, of neuroendocrine cancer. So I have an interesting relationship with death. I also, a career that I had before I was a writer, I worked in hospitals in the dietetic sector, and my dad was a doctor. So death is kind of part of it, I guess. And I just have...
You don't shy away from it in your fiction, and apparently in your life too. I mean, you have to make peace with it.
Yeah.
There's this grieving, and maybe there's grief that will never go away, but still you either, you know, fade away or you live on. I guess those are the only choices.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's similar to the fascination that I have with, you know, the politics and the alt-right stuff. It's like a puzzle. It's like, I want to be at peace with all of this, you know, so I'm going to plunge right in.
figure it out, let me know.
Well, I think that's part of the whole dangerous writing concept, you know, Tom Spombauer, who
right,
was a mentor
of mine. Right,
where
you started, yeah. And then you were in the, you had a spinoff with Chuck Palahniuk and Cheryl Strayed, Lydia, Monica.
Right, yep, yeah, all those wonderful people. And so writing to the raw part, don't shy away from it, right through a thing and really explore it from different angles. And, you know, that's what dangerous writing is all about. And it really spoke to me.
Yeah, and you've been doing that in your work. When you mentioned the moment before, which we did the interview, was it 10 years ago? It was
10
a while
years
back.
Ago, Ken.
Yeah, you have a line in there because I went back and looked at the book and my notes. Grief is a strange animal, Brady. It hovers and hovers and then it sees something and dives down. And that's a young adult novel. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not something you shy away with, shy away from. Death is and grief are very much a part of your work.
Yeah, seems to be.
Not to make it grim, but I think in a good way.
Right. Yeah, you know, the cycle of life. I mean, I think both my parents are still living and they're in their 80s. And I think that they have kind of adopted this peaceful idea of, you know, what's ahead too. So...
And it's a very Buddhist concept, too.
Yeah.
I'm not religious, really any religion, but if I had to pick one, I think I would pick Buddhism. There's other religions, too, like that, but it's important to make your peace, to recognize that death is there, to kind of live with it, to prepare for it, a good death, because they believe in reincarnation and you're in this Bardo state, this kind of liminal state.
Exactly.
And it could go anyway, you know, but it's karmic. So it's based on everything you've done in your last life and your past lives.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Now, in the book, Hazel belongs, we're still on the topic of grief. She belongs to a group actually called the Grief Group, and it's a support group for people who lost loved ones. They even have a bowling team in Spokane. All 300 bowlers. Now, did you model this group on any organization, meetings you attended when you lost your husband
Indeed.
And your sister and your sister-in-law?
The whole reason I'm up here in Portland... My husband died. I lived in my hometown in Warwick, New York. And then I ended up living with a relative for a while with my two little tiny kids in San Diego. And I joined a support group for young widows and widowers. So you had to be under 40. At the time, I was in my mid-20s. And I met a woman there who had lost her husband similarly. And she was raised in Portland. And she's Kelly Ambrose. And she said, you should really, because, you know, I couldn't afford to buy a house in San Diego back then. And this, when we're talking 1989.
Oh, now it's even worse.
Yeah. And she said, you should go up to Portland, Oregon. That's where I was raised. And it's still very affordable up there. Maybe, you know, you should check it out. I had a great childhood, she said. And I thought at the time, this is how dumb I was. I was like, oh, isn't that north of Washington State?
My relatives back east thought there were still covered wagons out here.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, when I moved up here in the 80s.
Uh-huh. Indeed. So anyway, after she just sort of, you know, laughed me off for a while, she said, yeah, go up there. And I'm going to give you a little lesson on how to pronounce things like Willamette.
Over in Cooch Street.
Cooch Street, yeah.
The two big ones. And Oregon, right, instead of Oregon.
Exactly.
Yeah, you got to know those three things. Yeah. You're a native.
There you go. So anyway, up I went on a little scouting mission in the summer of 89. And a month later, I moved here. And so anyway, so that was, you know, directly from meeting somebody in one of those support groups.
So very important for you.
Yeah, it was when especially, you know, young people who have lost their spouses and maybe they, you know, don't even have children yet or they have very young children.
You had two young children, didn't you?
I had a newborn and a 1.5-year-old. So there's specific things that go along with that in that part of your life, right? That people who lose spouses like later in life, you know, have different issues. So a lot of our things were getting together and going camping with all our little babies and getting some grandparents to watch our kids so we could go to Mexico and blow off some steam, you know.
Did they give you some tips for how to deal with grief? Well,
yes.
I guess the social activities were extremely important.
Yeah, there was always some sort of component about read this book, you know, that sort of thing. And
like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross type books.
Exactly.
The five stages of grief.
Yep.
How many there are. Yeah. I remember when my mom died, so this is back in 2009, and my dad was a lot older than you were when your husband died. And his inclination was to kind of go inside, just stay home. But he said he was kind of forced himself to go out, and that made all the difference. So those social activities that you had in the grief group, I think if he had a prescription for how to deal with grief like that, with a great loss, he would say, you know, get out there, talk to people, socialize,
Yeah, that's huge. That I think is really, really important. And, you know, at any stage of your life, if you lose a loved one, that you surround yourself with good people you can do things with.
Now, talking of good people, you're publishing now with Sibylline Press, and that focuses on publishing women writers, particularly women writers 50 and older.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you find out about Sibylline, and what appealed to you? Well, that's appealing right there.
Yeah, yeah. You know, on Facebook, you know, I saw this call out, and I think it was through my alma mater, Antioch, LA. I think it was on there. And I was like, this is interesting, you know. And then I read a little bit more about their mission statement. I thought, you know, I'm having a little trouble getting my stuff out there. I wonder if there's some ageism going on. And, you know,
I was going to ask you about that. That is definitely the case with a lot of the traditional publishers, isn't
it? Yeah. I think so.
Unless you're already established, like a Margaret Atwood.
Right. Have a huge readership or you just have this, you know, wild story to tell or, you know, whatever. But anyway, I'd already inked the deal for the Bequest with Running Wild Press.
And that's next year.
That's coming out September of 2025. Yeah. And I just finished editing my final draft of Bitterroot. So I sent that to them and they got back to me within 2 weeks and they were like...
Which is very unusual, right?
Very
a lot of writers
unusual.
Complain to get ghosted by agents and publishers.
Yeah. And since then, every interaction I've had, all the support, the community there, we're called Sibyls, you know, we promote each other's work. All of that stuff has been a dream. Just nothing that I've ever experienced in any of my publishing pursuits. So I love them. So yeah, I hope I can write more books for them.
And there was another Portland writer, Polly Dugan, I think, was
yes.
at Broadway Books. And you said she has a book coming out with Sibylline, too.
Correct. Yep. She just signed with them. So I'm excited to read that. And I've been doing a little editing for them as well, just because they have been signing a lot of books. And I'm like raising my hand for that.
I've always been curious. I don't think I asked you about this before, Susie, but how does... You edit, you're a book coach, and you were in a Tom Spanbauer's group, of course, and then with these incredible writers like you all together, exchanging knowledge, wisdom, or screw-ups, you know, and then how to fix them. How does that enter into your own writing? Is that somewhat unconscious? Do you have like a list somewhere of things to watch out for? Or, Susie, don't do this?
I think it's very intuitive, but you know... I don't have the same facility for my own work. In fact, I'm taking the book that I'm writing right now, I'm taking that to a big workshop this fall to, you know, get some other eyes on it. Because you don't, you know, the creative process is different from the editing process. And sure, if you put the book down for a number of months and you pick it up again, you have some objectivity. Mm-hmm. But I still think that you're connected to the story at a different level. So it's hard for you to see your own screw ups.
And I would imagine a writer might also make assumptions that the reader wouldn't.
Yeah.
So there's, course this character would do that.
And right.
I don't understand why.
That happens.
And that's the writer's fault. That's not the reader's fault.
Yeah. That you think that it's on the page and it's not on the page. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoy that part of my work life. And I usually start each day with my own work if I'm working on something, because I think that's when I can have the most creative juice.
And you have a 500 word rule, something like that?
I've been doing that, but I've upped it to 1,000 now because I want to get this done before I go to Italy later in August. So I need to get this done so I can hand it off to the workshop leaders there where I'm going.
I think you've said also you like to end where you're kind of still writing enthusiastically.
Yes.
I actually think that goes back to Hemingway, doesn't it? Didn't he have a suggestion like that? Mm-hmm. End where you know where to pick up the next morning.
Yeah.
You don't end where you're going to wake up. What was I thinking?
Exactly. And I like to sort of ruminate on where I leave off. You know, in the evening, I'll just sort of kind of, that's how I fall asleep, is thinking, okay, so I've ended with this character.
And like probably Pearl. Dream at night about it.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, it does. It enters your subconscious. So I always promote the idea that the word count really doesn't matter. It's maintaining the thread, I think, especially with the first draft. So that's what I counsel when I work with other writers.
I wanted to ask you, too, there's an audiobook of Bitterroot coming out. This month, right? In August?
August 13th. It's out. Yeah. Wow. It's going to be on Audible, you know, Tantor Media. So it's all of those.
And you're not the narrator.
Outlets. I am not. No, they actually have an Asian American woman who's going to be narrating it, who has narrated it. And actually, Ooligan is going to put out the audiobook of Faultland in the fall. So,
oh, who's doing that?
I think one of the students.
Oh, wow.
I heard a clip and it's really excellent.
Oh, great.
So these are firsts for me, having my books turn into audiobooks.
But it widens the audience. I listen to books through Libby, through the library.
Yes.
And you could take out an audiobook and I listen when I'm at the gym.
Exactly. Can multitask and get your steps in whenever. And, right. You know, and your eyes
and
get
tired.
And
rewind when
There you go. When you miss something. Yeah.
I miss some. Well, yeah. I miss a lot, but I go back. It takes me several months.
Oh, well.
But it widens the audience.
Yeah. My husband and I, when we go on road trips, we always pick a big tome, you know. So we were just getting through The Women. Kristen Hannah's The Women in our last road trip. And that was intense.
Now, you've done readings, not just in Portland, but around. Have you done anything in Northern Idaho, like Coeur d'Alene or Wallace? There must be bookstores in Wallace, isn't there? At least one, or maybe not.
I know there's
a big Walmart.
Yeah. Last time I was there. In Wallace, there is just a coffee shop, and they have very few books. It's kind of a coffee bookshop kind of a thing, but it's not really set up for that. But I was just in Montana, in Hamilton, Montana, and I taught a workshop there and had an event in conjunction with Chapter One Books, which is a wonderful bookstore in Hamilton, Montana.
Where's Hamilton? Is that near Billings or Bozeman around there?
It's near Missoula.
Oh, Missoula. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Western.
And like Idaho, Montana is that kind of very strange state with some very progressive pockets, but mostly red.
Yeah, exactly.
Outside of the cities.
I would say Hamilton's kind of half and half. But everybody really gets along there. It's a beautiful little town. If you ever, you know, go there.
I've never heard of it. I've been to Bozeman, which I like quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But they had, food co-op and outdoor store and very friendly people. Nice brew pub.
Yeah.
Montana Ale House.
Ooh.
Which was good.
Sounds great.
I want to talk about your novel, which is already done.
Mm-hmm.
So The Bequest comes out September 2025 from Running Wild Press.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little preview? Is it speculative fiction?
It is not. It is.
Do you have white supremacists in there? And siblings and
there's bad guys. there's a cartel.
Yeah, you described it as almost kind of a crime novel. If you had to give it a genre.
Yeah, it's my little foray into crime fiction. and there's a woman, a middle-aged woman. Who third person narrator, as well as a millennial young man. And it turns out they're connected through DNA. So that's all I'm going to say about that. but it is one of those things where there's, you know, a ticking clock and there's some bad guys that come and there's
a movie in that.
Yeah,
much more than an audio book.
Yeah.
That's going straight to film.
Well, it's set in Portland.
So, yeah, actually, Bitterroot is the only novel that's not set in Portland.
Correct.
Of yours.
Yeah, yeah. The Empress Chronicles, half is set in Portland and half is set in Austria, so there's that.
Now, you're also currently working on a novel, and that, I think from the description, it also features a pair of siblings, and in this case, two estranged sisters. So even though very different, like your sister and you, you had this bond between you, and apparently they don't, or there's a little more frazzled bond.
They were split up when their parents died in an accident when they were young, and one went to one relative and the other went to another person. And so they didn't grow up together, but they had different, very different personalities and different experiences growing up. And a situation occurs that puts them together. And the working title of the novel, can I say?
Oh, sure.
What is? Griftopia. So there's a bunch of grifters. And they all have their different ways, you know, of their push to the wall. And how do they, you know, how do they come up with their next, you know, mortgage payment or whatever. So there's a lot of that. Yeah, it's kind of a wild ride right at the moment.
Are you close to finishing it? Because you said there's a pub date or it's scheduled for 2026.
Yeah, I am actually still on the first draft.
But you want to finish that before your trip to Italy? Or?
Yes, and yeah. I am almost done with that. And then when I get feedback, come back over the winter, I am going to hopefully knock it out of the park and send it their way because they want to publish it for the following year. And it's always good to get the material to the publisher a year before the book comes out.
Wow. Well, you're very productive. So you're not a writer who just kind of sits and waits for inspiration to strike. And you're a true working writer.
I'm a Gemini man. Tried and true.
Do you still have the writing group, Susie? You mentioned a big workshop for the new novel.
Yeah. We haven't gone together in quite some time, but I think that there are people that I could, you know, hand it off to that would give me feedback for sure. And I do the same. But this workshop is the Writers by Writing workshops, you know, that Pam Houston heads.
Oh, yes.
And this one is in Utah. And the book, Griftopia, takes place mostly in Portland, but there's a couple of scenes in Utah and Salt Lake City, and there's a couple of scenes in Phoenix, which is another place that I lived. And the thing about Griftopia is I've included all kinds of little personal cameo things that have happened to me over the years that are kind of embedded in. Yeah, I worked in a hospital in Phoenix, Arizona as a dietitian.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. So one of my characters does that for a while, and then she becomes this wasn't my story, but she was on the junior tennis circuit, and so she ends up coming to Portland and having to make a living as a pickleball coach. And I'm really into pickleball now, so you know, all these things, right, that are hitting the media, and there's a, you know, a whole segment there about one of the characters exploiting their young child on the internet for followers and that kind of thing.
Do you have some neo-Nazis in there, white supremacists?
Not yet.
Embryo inspectors? Or no, that's the bequest.
Yeah, that's the bequest. I haven't gone down that dark path for this particular book, but I'm going down some other dark path. So.
Now, we have a little time, so I mentioned in the intro that we're both Portland Trailblazer fans, for better or worse, and the Timbers, too. The Timbers seem to be doing just fine. They won 4-0 last night.
Yes.
But any predictions on our poor Blazers for the upcoming season?
You know, my poor husband, he's going to, like, start throwing things at the TV screen.
I know the feeling.
Yeah. I think the thing about Portland is we go low, but we never go that low. So I think we're going to find
loyal,
critical.
Yeah.
I think we're going to find our way with the Blazers eventually. Maybe not this next year, but...
maybe before 2030, when Faultland takes place and the whole place blows up in an earthquake. You know?
Exactly.
It would just be our luck. That's their championship season. And
well, for now, at least we have the Timbers and the Thorns.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Susie, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure talking to you too, Ken. Thank you so much.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Susie Vitello, author of the new novel Bitterroot from Sibylline Press. You can find out more about Susie, her work, and all her upcoming events online at SusieVitello.com. And don't forget, the audiobook for Bitterroot is coming out this month. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month, usually from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, August 22nd at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying hope to see you all again then. Stop! Don't touch that dial. Always want to say that. We have even more Susie Vitello for you on today's Jonesy. We mentioned the Bitterroot audiobook is scheduled for release this month, next week, in fact. Well, thanks to the good people at Tantor Media, we have a preview for you. An excerpt from the opening pages of the book, as read by Cindy Kay, a Chinese-Thai-American narrator and educator who grew up in the California Bay Area and now lives in the Rockies. Coincidentally enough, the Bitterroot Range is part of the Northern Rocky Mountains. After listening to this brief sample, I think you'll agree that Cindy is the perfect voice for Susie's novel.
The knuckle rap at the door was all business. Betsy Jones, the real estate agent, was my first guess. She'd been after me to clean out my parents' house for years. And now that I'd finally ordered the dumpster, she was a regular visitor. She wouldn't let up about the time sensitivity. Hiking interest rates, the trend toward post-COVID buyer's remorse for Zoom town dwellers. Daily, she'd text me, "Folks are heading back to the big cities. You want to capitalize on your inheritance? TikTok." But even with Betsy's no-nonsense demeanor, it was too heavy a knock for her. This was a man's knock. Kendo, I thought. But why would he knock? Maybe because he knew Corinda was here. A last-minute decision. She needed the money, and we needed the help. "Coming," I yelled, as the knock gave way to the annoying chimes of the 70s doorbell of our childhoods. The door was mid-July sticky. It'd been raining all morning, but hot. Humidity made things swell, and as I wrenched it open, cursing in my head, the OCD plague Betsy would make us fix it before the open house, I felt Corinda's warm breath on my neck. Why did she always hover? The state trooper on the cracked cement stoop was already removing his hat. Behind me, Corinda yelled, "What's happened? Is it Kento?" My brother was due in any minute from Seattle. "No," she yelled, before the cop could answer. "Ma'am," said the trooper. As for me, my brain hadn't caught up to my eyes yet. I absorbed the whole of him like a quicksand dream that stretched yawningly forward. I worked my way from his bald head to his muddy shoes in slow motion. I said, "Can I help you?" His gaze leapt over me, mistakenly addressing Corinda with a steady, somber tone. "Mrs. McKenzie?" "No," Corinda replied, her hand settling on my shoulder. "She's Mrs. McKenzie." In grief group, during the formal meeting, the focus is on coping, on moving through it. But after the meetings, in the parking lot, all of us vaping, sipping the remains of cold, ground-littered coffee, we always returned to the what-ifs, the if-onlys.